Next up on This Week in Law, Venkat Balasubramani joins Mike Keyes, Emery Roan, and me, I'm Denise Howell. We're going to delve into the hazards of taking a selfie with your pit bull or your election ballot. We'll discuss the first text-to-register voter registration chatbot, the Slant's upcoming gig at the Supreme Court, Yahoo's email surveillance, the FCC's upcoming vote on broadband privacy, and much, much more. Join us next for This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, Emery Roan, and Mike Keyes. Episode 362, recorded October 7th, 2016. Making ballot selfies great again. This episode of This Week in Law is brought to you by FreshBooks, the super simple cloud accounting software that's giving thousands of freelancers and small businesses the tools to save time billing and get paid faster. Try it free at FreshBooks.com/TWiL. And by Grasshopper, stay connected and run your business from your mobile phone with Grasshopper. To save $50 on your order, visit trygrasshopper.com/twit. Hi, folks. I'm Denise Howell, and you're joining us for This Week in Law. Thank you so much for joining us. It is Friday, October 7th. We're back from our hiatus last week, and we're very glad to be here with you. We've got one of our favorite guests returning to the show, Venkat Balasubramani from Seattle, where he is a lawyer and the co-founder of Focal Law. And he also co-authors Eric Goldman's Technology and Marketing Law blog, one of the definitive sources for net law anywhere. So great to have you back on the show, Venkat.
Thanks for having me, Denise. And hey, Mike. Hey, Emery. Nice to chat with you both as well.
Yes, my co-hosts, Mike Keyes and Emery Roan are here.
Yeah, Venkat, I'm really looking forward to our conversation. I love your entries on the blog. So I think that we've got a lot of really great news to cover this week. And it's the 1 week before TWiL's 10th anniversary. So very exciting stuff all around. Denise, thanks for having me.
Oh, you're so very welcome. If you're joining us for the first time and you haven't met Emery yet, and he's a 3L at the California Western School of Law in San Diego, and he's cyber warrior in the making on all fronts. We're just thrilled to have him here with us. Yes. And Mike Keyes, my other co-host, is an IP partner at Dorsey & Whitney in Seattle, the co-author of The TMCA, his firm's blog about trademark, copyright, and advertising. Great to see you again, Mike.
Great to see you, Denise. Welcome back. And Emery, as always, great to be with you. And Venkat, my friend and colleague in Seattle and opposing counsel, great to have you with us today.
Thank you. I know.
Yeah, is this a first on This Week in Law, by the way? I'm not sure when we've had two guests on that were opposing counsel before. This is exciting.
We've had guests on, I think, who have opposed each other at one point in time or another, but not during an active matter. So I think we definitely are checking that box this time. And I'm thrilled that you brought it up, Mike, because I think people who aren't in the legal field probably think that inevitably, if you're opposite someone in an active piece of litigation, that blood would flow should you do something like this together. And although that can happen, that's more the exception than the rule. And I'm very glad that you two are cordial and that you're both here with us today.
Absolutely. I think you raise a really good point that, you know, even though we're adversaries, you know, there's plenty of room for us to also be friends in the legal profession. And I think by and large, we are. Certainly in Seattle, I think it's a very cordial IP litigation practice that we run. Maybe in other parts of the countries, it's a little bit more contentious. But here in the Pacific Northwest, we're maybe a little bit more laid back than in other locations.
Living the dream.
I love it. Yes, exactly. Although living the dream in the rain a lot of the times.
It's true.
Let's start out with a story that I'm actually not sure exactly when this all came to light. Emery, you'll have to enlighten me because I was out of town. But I know that it was either while we were gone, or while I personally was gone last week, or early this week. But it is the scrutiny that Yahoo is coming under for having cooperated with the U.S. government in monitoring users' real emails in real time. So that's obviously a privacy-related story. Let's start there. I know that Reuters had the exclusive on this. When did the news break?
Yeah, so there is a lot to unpack here. Reuters broke the news of this Tuesday of this week. So it is definitely a developing story, something we don't know all of the facts about, which I think is, you know, in part and parcel part of the story itself. Essentially, the story that Reuters broke is that sometime in 2015, Yahoo complied with a government request that is confidential to essentially scan hundreds of millions of people's email accounts in real time, scanning the contents of messages as they came in for apparently a specific string of characters that, according to the court order, was, you know, narrowly tailored to be, you know, only used by terrorists overseas. It's a pretty huge claim. The Reuters article sourced three anonymous sources close to the story, and I think circumstantially cited the resignation of the chief security officer, Alex Stamos. Where to begin on this? You know, this is something that we don't know all the facts about because, of course, the government has placed gag orders on Yahoo. You know, they're not able to tell us the whole story. You know, we don't even know if this is the FBI or the NSA because the government doesn't think that it's important enough to tell us. But, you know, the reports of how serious this are vary. I think the most benign explanation of this I've heard is that this is simply a fairly narrow expansion of systems that Yahoo and other email providers have in place already that scan email for spam and for known malware signatures and for child pornography. Apparently, you know, and under the most benign explanation, this was just an expansion of that, which is already pretty serious. And, you know, I think when this news broke, I think Matthew Keyes, maybe someone can correct me on that, but I think Matthew Keyes tweeted out that, you know, if you build these systems, they will come. So, you know, under the best of circumstances, this is the tired old story of we build these systems to stop child pornographers, and eventually it winds up sweeping up hundreds of millions of Americans. Of course, that is the most benign explanation. As the week has gone on, other articles have picked up the story. The Intercept apparently has separate sources that I have come out and said that this is not simply an expansion of email scanning features. This is actually a rootkit that was installed on the Yahoo internal mail servers that would have given hackers, had they access to it, complete unfettered access to the servers. This is more in line with the original report by Reuters, in that they said that the security team, first of all, this was approved by Melissa Meyer herself, according to original reports, and was implemented without giving a proper security review of the system, without even going through the internal security team. Alex Stamos apparently resigned in 2015. He was the head of security at Yahoo. He's now currently the head of security at Facebook. And he resigned apparently because he was not brought into the loop about this system. And that when they discovered it, it was apparently so shoddily implemented that they had real concerns that this had affected the privacy and security of hundreds of millions of users. You know, in light of 2 weeks ago, Yahoo's 500 million user data breach, I think that this is, you know, causing a lot of people to, you know, put a give a stern look at Yahoo, and they definitely deserve it. You know, the takeaways from this, I think, are numerous. You know, first and foremost, I think that this shows the problem with using gag orders against tech companies, that, you know, as much as they would maybe like to be transparent, they are not legally able to talk about these systems, about, you know, what they're doing. At the same time, that points to, you know, lack of oversight on these systems. You know, if this is under the best of circumstances, this is a story of, you know, law enforcement and government agencies pushing the envelope of these secret surveillance programs in novel ways, with the comfort that it's, you know, very unlikely that there's going to be any public oversight of this. So a developing story, rather scary. I think that it's definitely has, you know, some real actual costs already. There's talk that this is putting in jeopardy the EU-US privacy shield that, you know, obviously countless American businesses and European businesses are hoping to rely on to, you know, provide some kind of safe harbor for international data transfers. Yahoo, of course, is currently trying to be bought, and Verizon has responded by saying that, well, in light of this latest news, we'd like to take $1 billion discount on the offering. So, you know, rather than $4.3 billion, they're looking at $3 billion. So, I mean, that is, you know, if we're just talking about trying to establish injury for, you know, American businesses, you know, I think that can definitely make the case there. And, you know, I think that Alex Stamos, there's a great slide circulating around from a presentation he was giving, maybe at DEF CON. I'd have to double check on that. But, you know, he's he resigned after this, and he had a slide for a presentation that was given about the slide essentially said, you know, you're working for a major tech company and you discover that there is a new surveillance or, you know, user privacy impinging system being put in place. Do you A, resign and go public violating your NDA, B, you know, bring it up to the proper authorities, C, you know, roll over and break the law by implementing these systems, or D, put on your Guy Fawkes mask and begin monologuing.
Right.
So, you know, it's clear that this is something that he was thinking about at the time. He is no longer at Yahoo. I think that all the circumstantial evidence points to this being pretty serious. And, you know, even like I said, going under the most benign explanation that this is just an expansion of the child pornography and malware scanning features that every email service user or every email provider currently has in place, that's, you know, worrisome. That is that they are expanding this to, you know, use those systems to track terrorists. Right. What does that mean?
Right. And that they'll do it on a case by case basis. And in this case, it was under a confidential FISA court order, but
we don't even know that, by the way. Yeah, we don't know whether it was authorized under Section 02 of FISA or if it was a court order by the FISC. I mean, this is a clear indication. Like, if you are concerned about this at all, if you think that this is alarming at all, or even if you think that this is not a problem, that you know, this is a perfect example of why, you know, the government needs to keep secrets. Like, clearly, there's not enough oversight in the public because we are not even able to have a discussion on the facts of this.
Right. And it's disturbing for the public, I think, not to be able to square the Fourth Amendment with what happens under our anti-terrorism homeland security laws. Because they have an uncomfortable relationship with each other sometimes. Alex Stamos, I read, went to work at Facebook after this, and Facebook and Microsoft and Google and Apple have been quick to say, we don't do this. We haven't been asked to do this. If we were asked to do this, we would fight it. End of story.
Yeah. And I think that's, you know, one of the reasoning why the Reuters article said that their anonymous sources came forward and that Alex Stamos resigned is that, you know, Melissa Meyer, obviously to provide a little bit of context here, Yahoo has sort of a mixed history of, you know, rolling over or challenging these kind of orders under the government. In 2007, back in the Bush administration, you know, they were on the good side of things, fighting this order. And, you know, I think if people remember then, you know, they eventually backed down after the NSA threatened something like a $250,000 per day fine for continuing to challenge their order. But, you know, yeah, the fact that this was just that they just complied with this, I think, is something that the engineers apparently had a problem with, and that's why they brought this forth to Reuters. But this, again, so much of this is in the dark. We don't really know all the details of the story at all.
Okay. Mike Keyes, anything you want to add to this?
Yeah, I mean, the scope of this sounds unprecedented. And as Emery was saying, you know, there's still quite a few facts that still need to be put on the table here. We don't know if this was pursuant to a FISA court order. And of course, FISA is a piece of federal legislation passed back in the 1970s that does allow for gathering and collection of data somewhat cloak and dagger by the federal government. Of course, the judges that issue these orders are federal judges. They're appointed, I believe, by the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. There is oversight by the Supreme Court. So there are avenues that Yahoo, if this was pursuant to a federal court order, there are avenues that Yahoo presumably could have taken to challenge it. But, you know, I'm not necessarily supporting Yahoo, but they do have a privacy policy. Their privacy policy does provide that it will provide data pursuant to court order subpoenas and will also coordinate or cooperate with law enforcement requests. So it sounds bad, and I think it's it is bad, and it's rather extensive in its scope. You know, the privacy policy seems to suggest that this is something that they can do, and that consumers, you know, have to agree to in order to use the service. So I don't know. We still don't know all the facts, but it will be interesting to see how this all plays out once we know a little bit more.
Yeah. And I think that you bring up a great point that, you know, we're probably going to talk about a little later mm-hmm. with some of the topics we have today about, you know, the whole other side of this is, yeah, you know, I don't think that the privacy policy or that Yahoo is, you know, violating their own terms and conditions with their users. I don't think that's the problem, but it does point to the problem that, you know, users can assent to this kind of practice. And I don't think that, you know, even under a common sense reading of, you know, if people are actually reading the privacy policy and read and understand that, you know, they can provide data to government and to police, that this is necessarily what they had in mind, that it is, you know, that they're assenting to, you know, wide-scale dragnet surveillance of everyone's contents, of all, everyone's emails.
Mm-hmm.
But it does, the
other interesting point here is, remember when we discussed the whole FBI showdown with Apple,
right,
and where Director Comey testified before Congress about, you know, the process by which the FBI asked Apple to essentially, and I can't remember exactly all the ins and outs of it, but essentially they wanted Apple to cooperate with them in unlocking the phone, creating either some piece of software or something that would accomplish that task. I know the
right
folks at Apple were saying, no, we can't do that, because once we do that, that potentially, that workaround could fall into the wrong hands and it could compromise the security of the iPhone. So we now know about how Yahoo apparently developed some piece of code or software to allow this data collection effort to take place. And as we talked about a couple of weeks ago, we now have the biggest data breach in history, where 500 million user accounts were apparently hacked. Now, query whether that hack is related to this piece of software code that was developed by Yahoo to assist the federal government. It certainly raises an interesting and intriguing question in that regard.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think that is, you know, part of the major controversy here is about the differing stories, is that we don't know whether or not this was an expansion of previous systems, or if this was a entirely new piece of code developed, you know, a rootkit designed to do this specific task. And in any case, I think it's worrying. You know, if we talk about, you know, the fact that, by the way, you know, there is already spam filtering and malware filtering and child pornography filtering, those very same filters could be used to do this kind of practice, you know, is kind of alarming. And it points to the idea that Apple was absolutely right, that, you know, if you build these systems for X, they're going to be used for Y down the line. And, you know, without, I think, public oversight, or without, you know, real clear notice given to customers and users that this is happening, it certainly rubs me the wrong way. It's very wrong.
Venkat, what's your take?
I agree with Emery. I think it feels highly problematic. And, you know, I think a lot of these companies are in a tough position, but mm-hmm. They've lost any pretense of either independence or standing up for the rights of customers. And that could just be happenstance or the limitations of whatever law enforcement requests they do receive. for example, they can't tell customers about them. But, you know, you have situations where, as Mike pointed out, Yahoo will fight for the rights of end users and for the Fourth Amendment. And, you know, Apple does that, Yahoo does that, Google does that. But ultimately, we're left in a position where I think the average consumer can almost assume that every single one of these companies is going well above and beyond what's stated in their privacy policy as far as data collection and cooperation with the government. And that's I think that's a sorry state of affairs, unfortunately. I don't know if there's an alternative for other services. You know, maybe somebody comes into the vacuum and says, well, we're not like these other services. We're small. You know, we're designed in a way to maximize privacy. I know there's ones out there. You keep hearing about them, but none of them really seem to get any widespread adoption. So I think that's kind of an intriguing dynamic to watch, is to what extent consumers turn away from the Yahoos and the Googles and the Twitters of the world and think, you know, let's use some small system that is very, very privacy protective and designed that way. I'm also curious about the effect of stuff like this on the lawsuits that challenged government collection. You know, one of the big aspects of those lawsuits were that standing was very difficult to prove because you can't really show that collection occurred. And, you know, without making that allegation, the courts, for the most part, said, you know, you don't have standing to come into court. And I think, as with other disclosures on a larger scale, something like this, I wonder whether the plaintiffs that are trying to challenge government surveillance could go back and say, listen, we have proof that there is actual surveillance of emails of U.S. citizens or, you know, U.S. users or whatever, and mm-hmm. whether that will change the dynamic of being able to hash out the issue in court in a more transparent way rather than in a more obscure behind the scenes way. So,
yeah.
All right. Well, similar on a similar vein, the FCC is going to vote later on this month on its proposal on broadband privacy. And as you were talking through that, Venkat, it occurs to me that we're in a similar situation here. This proposal relates to ISPs and what broadband providers will need to do if this proposal passes to gather and share information on their users' web browsing and app usage. The proposal wants broadband providers to have to get customers opt-in consent for that kind of activity. It also provides how they have to use de-identified information. They have to use certain procedures to do that, and they have to commit to not re-identifying the information or allowing mm-hmm. others to do so. So it occurs to me that we're in a similar kind of situation here where regardless of whether this specific proposal passes, and it's pretty controversial, folks like the Center for Democracy and Technology think that it's a good idea, and I'm sure others on that sort of side of the advocacy spectrum agree that this is good for consumers and that, of course, consent for this kind of information gathering should be opt-in. We're once again back to the question that I hope we can delve into a bit deeper in the show as well on what constitutes meaningful consent in these kinds of contexts. And then there are others, and both Venkat and Mike write for blogs that cover not just the technology industry, but specifically as it intersects with the advertising industry, who think that the FCC's proposal here is too broad and that it could, if passed, the ISPs will be in the position of not having consent that would allow them to make beneficial use of data for consumers and could actually cause consumer harm. So Google, in fact, has weighed in and said, yeah, you know, we think that this proposal is a bit too broad. There are calls by some parties to extend this opt-in consent requirement to all web browsing information, and Google doesn't think that should happen.
I wonder why.
Yeah. And that calls it a novel and tested approach that would unnecessarily increase regulatory burdens on the internet. So this seems to be something of a hot potato that the FCC will vote on later this month. And particularly with your blog's focus on the advertising side of things, Venkat, I'm interested in your take.
Well, this is an interesting topic, and I wonder if what form the disclosure will take. And I know sometimes when you visit websites in the EU for a while, they had a big splash disclaimer that said this website uses cookies, you know, click here to agree and consent to use of your information. I'm curious as to whether the disclosures will end up taking that form, or will it be your cable guy or cable person when they're installing your cable modem sort of get you to initial one page that among 20 pages before mm-hmm. before you install saying we get to use this. To me, it seems like overly broad and, you know, taking a bludgeon to an ant, I guess, a type of problem. And I think consumers, I hate to say this, but I don't think consumers care because there's no, I think what would be more interesting to see how we could foster an ISP or a company that would actually be privacy protective, and maybe mm-hmm. they would charge more, but they would safeguard your privacy more. And this proposal mm-hmm. doesn't seem to accomplish that. It's just opt in or then you don't get to use your ISP, or you get to switch to a different ISP. And to me, it seems like an imperfect, overly broad solution. But I'm most curious about what form the disclosure will take. And I think there's a small related issue to this, and there's a bunch of litigation going on around it too, and technical activity, which is the do not track, and whether companies would respect do not track settings either on browsers or elsewhere. And it seems like a discrete issue, and I'm kind of curious to hear others' thoughts on whether that's something that is a small subset of customers who are taking that route, or mm-hmm. is that something that, mm-hmm. that sort of more broadly relates to this this consent around user information that the FCC is trying to push?
I think
let me see if I can unpack that a bit more. Are you thinking, Venkat, just spooling that out to a real world example of a customer in an ISP, that if someone has signed, whether in their big stack of documents with the cable person doing the install or clicked on something online indicating their opt-in consent to their ISP's use of their information, that if they were using a browser with do not track on, that they'd face some sort of adverse consequence from their ISP, or the ISP would come in and say, no, 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 you can't do that. You agreed to let us gather this data.
No, that's a good point, actually. I wasn't even thinking about mm-hmm. that. I was just thinking more that consent is undoubtedly, to the extent this is implemented, I think ISPs would obtain consent and jump through the hassle. But there's probably a separate group of consumers entirely, and I don't know to what extent they intersect, who are the do not track crowd. But mm-hmm. I think there's still ongoing uncertainty about whether people even have to respect do not track, and failure
exactly.
to respect do not track settings. Does that even amount to something you can sue over? I think courts are mixed and unclear on that. So as a customer, you don't have certainty, regardless of what consent you gave to your ISP, that somebody's even going to respect your do not track settings. And you know, yeah. advertisers and publishers circumvent them. And I don't know that there's much consumers can do to stop that. So
I think that brings up the exact point of why these kind of rules are necessary, because do not track, I mean, was one of those, you know, voluntary rulemaking sessions that didn't actually create any law around do not track, which is why when you look at any privacy policy ever on any web service ever, it says at some point, you know, we have heard of do not track, but because there's no universal standard, we, you know, respectfully do not like follow it. And so like, to your point, Venkat, about you know, being an overly broad or a bludgeon to an ant. I think that, you know, as a little bit of context, these are the rules that Tom Wheeler proposed about 6 months ago as one of the last projects I did at Privacy Rights Clearinghouse, the consumer privacy advocacy nonprofit here in San Diego. I was reading through hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pages of opposition arguments to these from advertising giants and tech giants. And, you know, their argument essentially comes down to, you know, either A, there's not a problem in the advertising space with competitiveness or with, you know, giving notice to consumers. B, this is exactly, you know, the foundation of all of the internet, and that, you know, we need to be able to serve these advertisements. And, you know, part of the advertisement model will not work if this is opt-in consent and not opt-out. And see that, you know, this is only going to affect, you know, ISPs and not edge providers. And at that point, you know, 6 months ago, I think Google actually was totally in support of these comments. It's a little surprising to see them come out and say that the FTC model is – oh, and by the way, that the FTC model is the model that should be followed and not the FCC model. So, you know, to go back even further, you know, this all stems from last year's open internet order that classified broadband internet access as a utility, which meant that under Section 222 of the Telecommunications Act, all telecommunications utilities companies under that section have to protect the privacy of their consumers. So these rules are the FCC's attempts to say, look, now that you guys are a utility, we're going to expand on the rules that all telecommunications companies have to follow, and we're going to actually enforce them. And, you know, to whether this is a bludgeon to an ant, this doesn't in any way say that these kind of practices are not allowed. It's not saying that companies can't, you know, track your personal information, track your geolocation, track your children's information, and use that to sell you advertisements. It's only saying that if you want to do that, you need to do it on an opt-in consent model. You need to actually ask the users, and they need to say yes, which I think is fairly common sense, reasonable requirements. You know, this is not – the FCC doesn't have the authority to dictate what they can do. It only requires that they protect the privacy and that they provide accurate, you know, good notice. I'm very interested, like you say, in what form the notice will take. In previous versions of the rules that Tom Wheeler has proposed, he's talked about requiring companies to make some kind of privacy panel or like a if you're familiar with Google's privacy toolkit, they have like a multi-layered plain English explanation of each of their privacy components and ways that you can opt in and opt out in certain ways. Whether or not these rules are overly prescriptive in that area, I'm not really sure, because on the one hand, I agree that you don't want to just have these huge, broad, you know, prescriptive rules. But on the other hand, you look at what the voluntary rulemaking procedures have created thus far, and that's do not track, and that is totally ineffective. You know, it feels like this is somewhere, you know, where, you know, market forces don't work. If you want the advertising agencies and the telecom giants and the broadband providers to protect your privacy, you can't ask them to volunteer to take less money from you. You know, this is the model of simply getting your one signature for the service and automatically assuming that that means you consent to sharing your data with all of their partners gets them a lot of money. You know, it's a huge revenue stream. Now, whether or not the internet can function, I don't, you know, that's something that I think we have to figure out.
Right. I have three thoughts to insert here. I want to hear from Mike Keyes on this too. I also want to put our first MCLE passphrase into the show in a moment here. But the three thoughts that are sort of batting around in my mind is that in the example I gave before about do not track settings in your browser, I think it could also lead to conflict with people using ad blockers, which are essentially performing a similar function. I'm concerned too about the notion that we have privacy-friendly ISPs that are competing on that basis and charging a premium, because that gets us to a web where only the wealthy and well-educated have privacy, and that's a bad thing. And then I forget what my third thought was. If it comes to me, I'll let you know. But my MCLE passphrase is back off my ant, because poor little ant, we've been bludgeoning it to the ground here. And we actually have right in the other room of my house right now a growing colony of carpenter ants. So this is near and dear to my heart. My kid has been watching Ants Canada. which has blown up on YouTube. He's this guy in the Philippines that teaches you all about maintaining ant colonies. And
I'm so into that.
They're very delicate and beautiful in their way. So I'm very sensitive to bludgeoning them necessarily at this point.
I feel like I should retract that comment.
I need a warning or something.
I think that's struck a chord, so I'll definitely retract that, Emery. And thanks for the explanation. I think that was very helpful.
Mike, what do you think about all this?
Well, I'm hoping that we have an ant selfie today to kind of complete the ant discussion here.
I'll find
all right, Chad,
one.
You know what you have to do.
It seems, and I'm not the first to jump in and say, oh, Congress needs to step in here and pass, comprehensive legislation. But, based on everything that you were saying, Emery, it seems to me like this area, I mean, you've got two different federal agencies that establish their rules, and these rules can change over time depending on who's running the agency and so on and so forth. It seems like this is an area that just screams for Congress to step in and set uniform rules to the extent that's even possible that would apply across the board with respect to privacy interests of consumers. It just seems like you've got a patchwork of different agencies that are stepping in to try to step into the breach and trying to figure this out. Maybe this is ultimately something where Congress needs to figure it out and pass comprehensive legislation that's going to deal with privacy for consumers. I'm not saying that's necessarily the case, but it seems like there's a pretty good argument that that's really where this should ultimately head.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Hopefully. Yeah. Good luck finding a Congress that will do that.
Yeah, right.
Yes. Just let's not worry about what Congress is going to look like until after November. And we'll go there. We're going to thank our first sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law, and that is FreshBooks. FreshBooks is the super simple cloud accounting software that's giving thousands of freelancers and small businesses the tools to save time billing and get paid faster. It's excited, FreshBooks is, to announce the launch of an all-new version of their cloud accounting software, which has been redesigned from the ground up and custom built for freelancers and small business owners. Yay! FreshBooks has created a super intuitive tool that makes it easy to create and send professional looking invoices in less than 30 seconds. I use it. I can tell you it takes me far less than 30 seconds to get an individual invoice out once it's in my system and it's a recurring thing. You can easily customize your invoice with your logo, your color scheme, any image that reflects your brand. Chat with your client regarding an invoice once they receive it. If there are any questions or discrepancies, you can clear that up quickly and make sure your client isn't just sitting there grumbling over your invoice and not paying it. You'll be able to see what invoices have been sent, viewed, and paid, as well as overdue and outstanding invoice totals. The modern and simplified dashboard works as the hub of your business, answering the most important question, how's my business doing? You'll have quick access to outstanding balances, spending, total profit, and accounting reports like sales tax summary and profit and loss. Tracking expenses is as easy as taking a photo of your receipt using the FreshBooks app. Track expenses by vendor and by category. Time tracking makes it easier to bill for time by client and by specific projects. Easily start your timer and track your time to the minute. When it comes time to create an invoice, you'll know what you did and when you did it. Get ready for the simplest way to be more productive and organized. Most importantly, get paid quickly. FreshBooks is offering a 30-day unrestricted free trial to our audience here at This Week in Law. To claim it, just go to freshbooks.com/twill and enter This Week in Law in the How Did You Hear About Us section. Start your 30-day free trial today. Thank you so much, FreshBooks, for your support of This Week in Law.
All right. I just want to chime in super quickly before we move on from privacy to Venkat's earlier point about companies that are, privacy focused from default and, whether we're going to see more from them. There is, of course, a great piece of news this week about Open Whisper Systems, the people behind Signal, which I've talked about many, many, probably too many times on the show. But they responded in a way that just shows exactly why companies that are privacy focused from the ground up, have a strength here in that they were able to make a point to advertise that their privacy policy and that their systems do not collect any information. So they were able to talk about how a FBI letter, how, you know, they were you know, petitioned for information on some of their users, and they provided them exactly what they could, which was next to nothing. And I think that privacy advocates and, you know, technologists and people that were paying attention to privacy news this week, you know, were like, look at this. This is exactly what you should be doing. So, yeah, hopefully we see more like that. Yeah, you know, more privacy-focused companies from the ground up.
Wonderful. And since we're about to lighten things up considerably here, it looks like Mike has found us that very ant selfie. if you're able to show it to us, Victor, in the studio, we'd love to see it. Or you can save it till we do our animal selfie of the week, and you can add it to that segment there. I will leave it to you, Victor, where
I'll,
we
I'll save it.
All right. Perfect. Ants to come, folks. And unicorn toots to come next in our copyright segment. I just love this story, and it's a great example of why I love doing the show and having guests come to us each week and their own interests and things that they've noticed on the web inform and add to what we put in the show. This is something that Venkat noticed somewhere and tweeted about recently, and it is a lawsuit by a woman named Lisa Phoenix, who is an artist and designer. She has a site called SugarHai.com, and she makes, now I'm going to butcher the pronunciation on this, but her art is in the genre of Kawaii, K-A-W-A-I-I, which references that it is very cute, and it is the kind of sort of anime-inspired Hello Kitty, Japanese cute kind of things that... I don't know, that people love, that are super cute. And so, unfortunately, she has needed to, sue Amazon and Woot, which, does shirt Woot. And we here at Twit, I should mention, have, relations with shirt Woot and put shirts up there for sale, et cetera. I believe, I think I've bought Twit shirts at shirt Woot before. Maybe I've only bought shirts that say pew, 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 because I know we have some of those laying around. But it's a wonderful, site that, sort of relies on the great imagery that it's putting on its t-shirts. Those t-shirts wouldn't sell in any other case. And here, Lisa Phoenix has made an image. Victor, if you go to the complaint, or if you go to Lisa's site, either way, you should be able to find the picture in question. If you scroll to like the second page of the complaint at the digital comments, there you go. There it is. So she made this delightful image of a unicorn evacuating its sprinkle-filled bowels on top of a cupcake. And there's a slogan, I believe, that goes along with the image. Sugar is sweet, lemons are tart. I love you more than a unicorn fart. Lisa is unhappy because this image of hers, which is copyrighted and she controls the rights to, wound up on a shirt Woot shirt, which I double checked this morning before the show. They no longer are offering that shirt, at least not when you search for unicorns on their site. So they seem to have taken it down. As the result of this lawsuit. So we don't know much more about it, except that this complaint has been filed and it involves adorable unicorn tooting artwork. Venkat, anything to add since you flagged this on Twitter?
Well, I don't know her personally, but the artist is actually a Seattle resident. So there's that factoid. The paragraph on the show. The complaint says that she resides in Seattle, Washington. But, you know, I think it's just feels like a typical copyright lawsuit, except for the very cute subject matter. And I think there are a lot of copyright lawsuits against Amazon and Woot, and maybe not Woot, but against Amazon. And in general, I think that's an issue that Amazon has pretty skillfully defended against over time, historically. And so my guess is this lawsuit will probably settle sooner rather than later. But I think I'm curious to see what Amazon says, if anything, in defense, or whether it'll just settle and, you know, pay the artist or tell the artist that they'll take it down and keep it down. So,
yeah. And Patrick Delahanty, thank you so much for reminding me that, no, here at Twit, we use Teespring, not Woot, but certainly have ordered from Woot before. They have a lovely selection of items. And Lisa Phoenix has a lovely selection of artwork on her site, and I guarantee you, we would, as you say, it's a pretty run-of-the-mill copyright lawsuit, Ben Catton. We wouldn't be talking about it unless the art featured, which it does, tooting unicorns. anybody else want to add anything? Find anything particularly novel to add that I've missed here?
So I was wondering, I didn't see the actual shirt that is in question. Is this like a strict literal takings of the art in question? Amazon,
it looks like it. Yeah, they included a photo, you know, an image in their complaint, and it says in the complaint that exhibit 2 to the complaint is the shirt. So I wonder if they actually filed the shirt with the court, or if they simply had a graphic of the shirt. But I'm guessing that the image in the complaint is precisely what appears on the front of the shirt, but I don't know. I'm just going by what they pled.
I was just thinking, it's surprisingly common, the unicorn pooping imagery. So I wasn't quite sure if it was one or the whole host of other nearly, you know, very similar graphics.
Oh, well, and are you kind of working toward the fact that maybe this is so common that it couldn't be copyrightable?
I mean, the bar of creativity is so low. I think it's really easy to overcome that. But at the same time, I was just sort of thinking, is this, you know, we've seen other cases where it's not quite the same exact image that they're copying, but it's just so darn similar that I'm sure it's copyright infringement, but it's not really. So
fascinating. All right. Well, let's move on. Keeping things fairly light, unless you're one of the litigants involved, or unless you are dying to see, as at least some of us are on the show, I'm sure, Axanar go into production and onto our screens. Let's move over to Hollywood and update the status of the Axanar lawsuit. So you might have thought back in June that based on what J.J. Abrams had said in connection with the release of Star Trek Beyond, that the suit against fan film Axanar, although I guess there's some dispute in the litigation as to whether this is, quote unquote, a fan film or not, since it has such high production values, etc. But J.J. Abrams at the time said, gee, you know, we really, this is not what we should be doing. We should let fans help the brand and express their enthusiasm, et cetera. I'm paraphrasing. But the lawsuit didn't go away. And in fact, it has now entered its discovery phase. What happened in the meantime is that triggered by or in connection with the comments that J.J. Abrams made, Paramount and CBS did put out some guidelines for fan films, but as we've talked about on the show, they certainly don't really encompass something like Axanar. Something of that scope and length and subject matter wouldn't fit within the guidelines that were released. So that, you know, for lack of a better explanation, seems to be why the lawsuit is still proceeding. Axanar can't make its film, so it has to continue litigating away, and Paramount thinks that they're infringing and they're not complying with the guidelines, so they are still being sued, and now they're fighting about discovery. Some of the things that are at issue is that the Axanar folks want to get at all the communications between Paramount, CBS, and J.J. Abrams and Justin Lin about fan films and this lawsuit. Paramount is fighting that, saying it's not relevant, doesn't bear on anything that would have gone into the infringement. Like many discovery disputes, there's much back and forth about what's relevant to the claims in the case and what is bludgeoning an ant, perhaps, with your discovery request by being overbroad, and what's not. Wondered. I'm not even sure who put this in the rundown, so I'll kick it to whoever did to add whatever they'd like.
It was actually me, Venkat, who put it in there. And I just like the story because I think this lawsuit involved one of my favorite all-time briefs, the Klingon brief.
The Klingon brief.
Yes.
filed by Mark Randazza. And I think so it caught my attention. And the lawsuit in general is pretty interesting. And I think after Mr. Abrams made his comments, I actually remember seeing something on Twitter to the effect that the lawsuit actually settled. And so I wouldn't be surprised to see the filmmakers get some sort of documents around the communications, or if after J.J. Abrams made these statements, the studio came back and said, you know, this is different than what we're thinking, et cetera. I would think that type of communication would be relevant on some level. And I just thought it was interesting that, you know, you have the filmmaker, the creative person, who obviously felt like the lawsuit was inefficient, shouldn't be maintained, and the studio shouldn't fight it. But the studio had a different perspective. And I thought it was interesting to see that difference play out publicly and now in this discovery dispute that as a follow-up. So,
couple of things for me. First, Venkat, if you haven't seen our episode with Mark Randazza that was right shortly after he filed the brief, you should pull that up because it was good fun. And secondly, I'm wondering if any of you think that there's an argument to be made here that statements by Abrams and Lynn have a binding impact, some sort of estoppel or latches or license that could apply to the statements that they made.
I'm definitely interested in hearing what the results of the discovery are. I think the contents of those conversations between Abrams and the studio, I agree with Axanar's attorneys that, you know, that would go towards showing the market effect. And to your question of whether or not the statements that the lawsuit, I think, was quote ridiculous and would go away soon, you know, did that give any kind of implied license to continue work? I think that's really interesting. I definitely look forward to hearing the argument that they make on that front. I have said before numerous times that, you know, I am torn because I'm in the situation where I really want these projects to be able to succeed and go forward. But at the same time, I don't think that they necessarily stand on the traditional four-factor fair use analysis. But the market effect would be a huge factor in that analysis. And if the if there are internal comments from Paramount saying that, we're happy that Abrams made this, you know, statement because it, you know, pulls off negative press about our film, or, you know, whatever, to the effect that it, you know, the Axanar project is or is not going to affect the market success of their latest big, Hollywood blockbuster, think would definitely be, relevant to that analysis.
Right. And I'm glad you brought that up, because it reminds me of the fact that it's all about the advances in and access to technology that we're even having this conversation. When I attended a Star Trek convention when I was 8 years old and we screened fan films there, the ones that they showed had little ships, you know, tied to fishing line coming across the screen and looked ridiculous. And of course, we're greeted with rousing applause and enthusiasm and appreciated for what they were, but they were no competition to the actual copyright holders. And time unfolds and technology advances, and we're in a completely different situation as to what you can accomplish on your own and with crowdfunding and
Yeah, you know, unfortunately for I think unfortunately maybe for Axanar, you know, Star Trek in particular, the audience is more receptive to maybe lower budget, or at least at the very least more receptive to pushing back against the current big budget Hollywood imagining of Star Trek. So, you know, does that mean that they would be more likely to have a negative market effect or not is something that I think is, you know, could be litigated, could be argued either way. Yeah, best of luck to Axanar. But, you know, the cynical side of me is so, like, I feel like I was saying this or thinking this would happen way back when, you know, Abrams was making these comments. It was like 2 weeks before the release of their new film. And, you know, the film was just getting a lot of negative press about the way that they were treating their diehard fans. So Abrams says something that makes all of that go away for the 2 weeks before the film comes out. And, you know, of course, as we talked before, that didn't just go away. And it's continuing to boil up underneath the surface. And, you know, yeah, by now it's I don't think that anyone is going to choose not to go to see the latest Star Trek movie because of Axanar. You know, so I don't know if it was just a PR move by Abrams, if that has any relevance in the fair use analysis or not. But I look forward to seeing what Axanar digs up.
Right. Mike, any thoughts?
Yeah, so this 98% of all intellectual property disputes, or to put it in Klingon, mine property law disputes settle. So I think chances of this settling are pretty high ultimately. It does raise some pretty fascinating questions, though, as to the scope of fair use in this context. As we've talked about on the show before, you know, the two overriding fair, even though there are four different fair use factors that are looked at, really the two that are the most prominent would be whether it's one, transformative, and two, whether it's going to affect the market value for the work, for the copyrighted work. So I think there seems like there's good arguments for this, for the defendants, that look, this is advancing fair use. It's very transformative in a number of respects. And to Emery's point, I'm not sure that it's going to ultimately affect the market value of the underlying work. So I don't know. It's we may never know the answer. There may never be a court decision on this because it may very well settle, but it's going to be great to see how this all plays out.
And I will say that, you know, with the cosplay community, with the fan community, this is something that is not going to just go away. You know, if this just gets settled and we don't hear any new law about this, this is an issue that is not solved and is not restricted just to Star Trek. You know, if, you know, fans are, like you said, Denise, the technology is getting better and better so that fans can make, you know, their own works that are homages or are, you know, integrating or combining or transforming in some way these protected works every day. So yeah, there need, it feels like everyone's gut take in 2016 is that, yeah, you need to have some way of fan projects to exist. But, you know, if we're taking down the four factor fair use analysis and you look at the transformative factor and we look at the market effect factor, the way that those have traditionally been weighed before is that, you know, if it's not saying something or commenting on something in a way that is different from the original, it's not transformative. And so I'm not necessarily sure that having Klingons do different Klingon things is necessarily transformative. And, you know, the market effect has traditionally been considered to say, well, if they're still selling the original work, then, you know, your work could negatively affect the market of that if it encourages people to not go to the original. And so, again, like that, if you're producing a very highly polished, super pretty CGI, including, you know, maybe B-list actors, you know, quality writing, I don't know.
Your point is that the advances in technology and access to funding actually could cut against a finding of fair use because it's so far closer to the original than it would have been back in the day. Little chips on fishing line are nothing if not transformative. Let's move on. A couple of quick hit stories before we get into some meteor stuff at the end of the show. First one involves the social web. I love having Venkat or his co-author at their technology and marketing law blog, Professor Goldman, on the show because they are constantly writing such interesting posts on their blog, and we can just pepper the show with posts from their blog. And that's what we're doing right now. Interesting thing, if you're an attorney or even if you're not, is how you can successfully give notice. And this goes somewhat to the contract discussion we've been having all along in the show and hope to have in more in depth later as we wrap things up. This has to do with what means are valid service of process to assure a court that you have notice that a lawsuit is pending against you and that you have ample opportunity to respond and represent yourself in that lawsuit. If you jump through all the hoops in accomplishing service of process, even if you don't respond, a judgment can be taken against you. So it's something that courts are cautious about. They want to make sure that the notice being given is adequate. And we've had sort of a progression much like along the way from ships on fishing wire to Axanar, we've had a progression as technology has advanced and social media has come to the fore as to what courts will accept as valid service. And I remember it being controversial when people first got a court to approve service by email. Then there were some cases about service via Facebook, and now we have one authorizing service of process via Twitter. Can you tell us more about this, Venkat?
Yes. This was a lawsuit brought against financiers of terrorist attacks, I think ISIS-related, and St. Francis was the plaintiff in the lawsuit, and it sued several defendants, and one of the defendants was a Kuwaiti national, and the plaintiff couldn't serve the defendant via traditional means, using a service of process company in Kuwait, I presume, or using the Hague Convention. And so what it did was ask the court whether it could serve the defendant via a Twitter account. The defendant had been very active on Twitter and had allegedly even conducted some of the activities the plaintiff was complaining about. And it presented this proof to the court, and the court said, yes, that's fine. The court was not specific about how exactly that service should take place. And that's a weird thing to focus on, but I think as lawyers, we, you know, that's the kind of stuff that catches our attention. It, you know, it didn't say whether the plaintiff had to say anything special, send it via direct message, post it as a link, or post it publicly, et cetera. You know, those details were left up to the plaintiff. And in one of the articles after the ruling came out, it quoted the plaintiff's lawyer as saying, you know, the plaintiff had yet to tweet its lawsuit to this particular defendant, which I thought was kind of funny. But coming back to your point about email and the evolution of the law, I think everyone would probably agree that email is available in certain contexts against foreign defendants. And why email works, I think, is that more often than not, and at least the few times I've done it, you go to court and you say, here is somebody conducting business via email and doing stuff I'm complaining about. They're publicly or prominently using this email address. Here's communications sent using the email address. Let me send an email of notifying this person of this lawsuit to this email address because they're obviously using it to communicate and conduct business activities or whatever activities. And I think there's always a concern that, you know, maybe it gets caught in the spam filter, maybe the person doesn't read it. But the notion is that if the person's using email in a way that's connected to the lawsuit, that's not a requirement. But I think typically that's something that could sway the court. It seems reasonable to use that email as one of the ways that you would notify the defendant of a lawsuit. And I think email, despite it being not having an assurance that the person's going to read it, still feels better than, say, Twitter or Facebook from the standpoint of we miss a lot of tweets. You know, we miss stuff on Facebook. And I think the chances – we miss emails too, but the chances are a lot less that you're going to miss an email. And I think there's a lot of other ways you can simply not come across a tweet, or perhaps you blocked the person, or your profile goes private or what have you. I think there's a lot of scenarios we can look at in which the person would actually never receive notice of the lawsuit. And so that's what – I thought that was kind of interesting that – the court would be somewhat nonchalant about it and say, yeah, Twitter's fine. You know, you can just do it via Twitter. There wasn't even an email address in the case that the plaintiff pointed to as an additional way to provide notice to the defendant. So that's why I thought that that particular ruling was interesting and I flagged it.
Yep, it sure is. Any other thoughts anyone wants to add before we move on? Okay, then let's move next to the Slants. Who are about to rock the Supreme Court. Simon Tam and his musical group, The Slants, who tout themselves on their website as Chinatown Dance Rock, we're at least working with Simon to pin down a date when he can come on the show and talk more about the case. We're excited about that. They were granted cert by the U.S. Supreme Court. It means their case will be heard in this next term, very nicely written up and very punnily written up by Mike at the TMCA.com. Mike, anything else?
I am shocked that Mike included puns in his article.
I know. Shocked. Just shocked.
I don't know how to do it any other way.
I'm so excited to see Simon and the group stroll into the court. Maybe they'll do a set or two and then we'll get down to the argument. What do you think, Mike?
That would be wonderful. You know, as we've talked about before, we hosted the Simon Tam and the Slants in our office in Seattle earlier this year and really enjoyed it. We put on a CLE panel discussion featuring Simon, and then he and his band performed for an hour or so. So I think that would be a perfect complement to the oral argument, have Simon and his band rocking out, you know, in DC there. I don't think it's a huge shock that the court accepted this case. It was a pretty significant ruling by the Federal Circuit. The full mm-hmm. Federal Circuit, of course, found that Section 2A of the Lanham Act was unconstitutional and found it unconstitutional. It was facially invalid. And what that means is essentially the statute as written is invalid. It violated the Constitution. It wasn't just unconstitutional as applied to Simon Tam, it was unconstitutional across the board. So pretty sweeping, significant ruling by the Federal Circuit. Of course, we've got the other side of the story here is the NFL football team, the Washington Redskins. They too are dealing with the identical issue in a parallel proceeding that's currently before the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals. And what the Washington Redskins counsel attempted to do was try to get the court to accept the Redskins case for review by the Supreme Court, bypassing the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, which in and of itself is a very that is something that happens very irregularly. You always have to go through the trial court and then the federal appellate court level and then ultimately to the Supreme Court. So the court accepted the Simon Tam case to address the constitutional issue, and it did not accept review of the Washington Redskins case, which is currently set for oral argument before the Fourth Circuit, I think here soon in the next few weeks. The Washington Redskins have asked to put that oral argument off, essentially pending decision by the United States Supreme Court. So one other potential wrinkle here is we, of course, still only have 8 justices, and a case like this could end up in a 4-4 split potentially. And if that's the case, then when the U.S. Supreme Court splits, the lower court decision stands. So, you know, there's some increased drama in that respect too. You know, we've got a very divided court on a lot of issues, and this could certainly be one where we've got people on both sides of the fault line here. So it's going to be very interesting and great to see this play out. There is no, at least as of yesterday, I noted that there is no oral argument date set, but it's sometime set for this October term. So stay tuned. It's going to be really fascinating to see. We'll have to have Ron Coleman and Simon on the show. It would be great to to get their take on how everything went.
I would, if they can take time out from prepping for argument, et cetera.
They have said they're going to come on the show as soon as they have the opportunity. But we had some tentative scheduling for later this year. I think that we're going to push it back to early 2017. But stay tuned to Twill because Simon will eventually be on the show.
Excellent. I can't wait. We're going to talk for a moment about some things you need to know in this election year, legislative and policy sort of concerns. But before we do that, we're going to thank our second sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law, which is Grasshopper. Grasshopper, if you haven't heard of it, is a virtual phone system designed for entrepreneurs. Grasshopper works just like a traditional phone system, but requires no hardware purchase or software installation. With their iOS and Android app, callers can reach you wherever you are on your mobile phone. Grasshopper allows you to keep your existing number so you can maintain your brand. When you make a call, your client will see your Grasshopper caller ID instead of your personal phone number. Simply select a toll-free or local number, record a custom greeting, and add multiple extensions for your business. Toll-free numbers are great for marketing and make your business sound more professional. Set up department and employee extensions with custom call forwarding to any phone in the world. Get voicemails emailed to you as audio attachments. You can also send and receive SMS text messages from your business number. Join the over 250,000 Grasshopper customers today. Plans start at just $12 per month. You have a 30-day money-back guarantee as well. Turn your smartphone into a business line with Grasshopper. To save $50 on your order, go to trygrasshopper.com/twit. That's trygrasshopper.com/twit. Thank you so much, Grasshopper, for your support of This Week in Law. All right, let's sojourn over to the ballot booth. Lots of litigation going on around the country about ballot selfies, legalizing them, not legalizing them. The state of New Hampshire just got a ruling where folks can go into the polling place and take a picture of their ballot. This is not technically a selfie in that the ballot is incapable of taking a picture of itself, there are many places in the country where that is not okay. There are others where it is. We'll point you to a resource later in the show where you can figure out exactly where you stand as far as being able to take a ballot selfie and post it or not. But many people like to do this. It sort of goes along with those, hey, I voted stickers for people to be able to demonstrate that, yes, they were there and they place their vote. Here in California, we have very good vote by mail laws, and I haven't seen the inside of a polling place in many, many years. In fact, I sort of took my son into one, sort of like a museum visit that was at his school, because schools and libraries and things are frequently polling places. And since I've never been to one, he'd never been to one. And we went in, we toured it, and they gave him a sticker, and it was very, very nice. But the physical polling place is no longer relevant in my life. That's not true of many, many other people in the country. And there's no reason why you couldn't take a picture of your vote by mail ballot as well, except if it's illegal in your state, which it is in California. So anybody have anything to add to the whole ballot selfie issue? There seems to be a sort of freedom of expression, promoting voter participation aspect to these disputes, this issue that comes into play. Venkat, what do you think?
I would agree. I think it's a great decision that recognizes the expressive value in pictures and the type of stuff people post online. I think it was interesting that Snapchat participated or submitted a brief as a friend of the court. you know, I'm not a Snapchatter, but it was interesting to see that they chimed in and the court actually cited from their brief favorably. So overall, it's a great decision. I like it. And I think it calls into question a lot of these other restrictions in other states that try to restrict posting selfies in the voting context.
Mm-hmm. Right. I guess the counter argument is they're trying to prevent voter fraud. Somehow they think that photography in the polling place is not a good thing. It's a security issue. I'm not quite sure. I haven't read the briefing in the
case.
Yeah,
that sounds ridiculous. What is the same argument that having visual photographic evidence of my vote somehow encourages voter fraud? What?
Yeah.
I don't know. I think this is the argument that that ballot selfies in any way sort of erode the sanctity of voting, I think is like a very bad argument to be making, considering that our voting percentages are approaching 50% in the best of times, and we're somewhere closer to 30% during the last midterm election. So, mm-hmm. anything we can do to make voting a more entertaining, a more civic minded, a more community activity, if that involves posting it to the social media, I think is probably a good thing.
Right.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I'm not that familiar with the dispute either, but I assume that they're worried about, or these states that have these laws are worried about selfies with the ballot, and then people get a look at what the ballot looks like, and mm-hmm. they can gin up fake ballots and then stuff the ballot box somehow. I mean, I assume that's what it's got to be at.
All right. Well, the other thing is
this seems so painfully unconstitutional. I mean, it's a content-based restriction. You're restricting the content of a photograph that somebody can take, and it's clearly content-based. It's mm-hmm. got to be unconstitutional. I'm glad to see that the First Circuit is making ballot selfies great again.
Absolutely.
And to the point of voter fraud, you know, there is so much possibility of voter fraud in democracies going back forever. You know, if we're like, this is not the kind of thing that could prevent ballot stuffing or could prevent wide scale voter fraud at all. The real threat to our voting system is the terribly insecure infrastructure that we have. You know, we had mm-hmm. an article about this a couple of weeks ago, but we have effectively 9,000 equally insecure county voting systems. Where, you know, it only takes one or two of those to be compromised to turn an election. I'm not at all worried about people posting their, voting results on Snapchat. I think that's insane and just distracts from the real point.
And I think the two reasons given by the legislature were voter coercion and vote buying, I think, were the two ways they tried to justify the law. And to me, it seemed pretty antiquated, and the court said, you know, these are just hypothetical concerns that may have been around way back when, but there was just scant evidence of it. So the one interesting side note to this ruling is there's a footnote that actually talks about a selfie being defined, and this was from Snapchat's brief, being defined not strictly as a photo where the photographer is also a subject, but rather all smartphone pictures shared online, including those here. I thought that was kind of funny that a ruling from a federal appeals court would delve into the definition of selfie. So there you have it.
A little broad. Talk about bludgeoning an ant. I think we could get in trouble over that, but it's dicta. All right, and Emery,
not to beat a dead ant, but
it's very dead at this point.
Then, Cap, maybe you can explain for us what is the vote purchasing angle to this? How is a selfie with your ballot going to? I don't even understand the concept.
I assume it's like a receipt.
Exactly. I think that's right. I'm not looking at the distance.
Because vote buying couldn't exist before you have a receipt of it.
I think that's right. I mean, that sounds crazy to me, but I think that is the rationale. Is you would produce photographic proof for somebody who then, I guess, presumably paid you to vote a certain way. So I think vote buying, that was what it was tied to, a receipt aspect of it. That seemed far-fetched to me, but that's my recollection of.
At the same time, it seems far-fetched to me that people want to publicize their votes on everything. I don't know. Have we really moved into that social media world where, because presumably if you're taking a picture of your ballot, you have filled it out and people will know how you voted. And that's one of the purposes of the polling place, is to keep that confidential. I don't know. I mean, that
based on my Facebook feed, I don't think that anyone that I know is interested in keeping that vote confidential. Not a single person.
Yeah. Well, but you know, but Emery probably wants to keep his vote secret when he votes for Trump. You know, he's not going to want to tell everybody he's done that.
Well, and so to answering your question, that I think that
disparaging remarks, by the way,
it was related to vote buying. One of the proposed amendments to the bill suggest, it was not adopted, this amendment, but it suggested limiting the law to posting digital images or sharing online only if the distribution or sharing is for the purpose of receiving pecuniary benefit. So I don't know if it's necessarily vote buying or promotion, you know, paid promotion or something like that, but certainly just getting paid to post your ballot selfie was one purported concern of the legislature that the court said there's no there's no evidence of this anywhere. So
right. I wonder how the campaigns in the states where it's legal will treat this, if they will encourage people to post their cast ballots, you know, to show that they're favoring their candidate or whatnot. I've never seen something like that in a past election. I wonder if we'll see anything like it this year. So keep your eyes peeled and let me know. Let's see. Oh, I wanted before we leave the polling place, I wanted to mention something that Emery tweeted about from fightforthefuture.org. The first instance I've seen of a text to register voting chatbot. So I think how this works is you text your intent to register to the bot and it registers you and it sends you back confirmation and voila, you are a registered voter. Is that it in a nutshell, Emery?
Yeah, that's it in a nutshell. And, you know, I mean, I got to give a lot of credit that it is very easy to register to vote. There are very easy systems in place already, websites. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm sure you've seen the YouTube ads where it takes a minute and 30 seconds to register for vote and go do it now. Yes, you should do that. But at the same time, it's these kind of initiatives that really make me optimistic about the future. You know, this is a chatbot sort of along the similar lines as Joshua Browder's Do Not Pay bot we talked about a few months ago. But yeah, it is a chatbot where anyone with a regular cell phone that has SMS capabilities can text message to register to vote, you know, in plain English, conversationally.
Any jurisdictional limitations?
I don't think so. I think that it works. You know, I'm going to maybe insert my foot into my mouth, but it works in all 50 states. Yes. Yes.
All right. We're going with it until proven otherwise.
I've got it. Hello Votes technology works in compliance with voter registration regulation in all 50 states.
There we go. Wonderful.
It's their fault if they're lying.
Cool. So if you're just one of those folks who really wants to try out a new way to register, check that out at what's it called again? Fightforthefuture.org. Let us put a final MCLA passphrase into the show. I neglected to explain what these are before. I'm just sort of assuming that people have listened to the show and have heard me put these in dozens of times. But if that is not you, let me tell you what these little phrases are that I'm dropping in the show. If you're a lawyer or another professional who likes to listen to the show for continuing education credit, there are some jurisdictions that ask that you have proof of that you validate that you actually watched or listened to the show and that you didn't just write it down on a list and turn it in. So we put these phrases in so that you can say, hey, you know, I know the phrases, so I actually watched or listened. They're inserted at random into the show. And our second one is going to be selfie your vote, with the caveat, please only do that in states where it's legal and you're not going to get in trouble. Selfie your vote is our second MCLE passphrase for the show. And if you want more information about professional education credit for the show, head on over to wiki.twit.tv, find our show page there, This Week in Law, and there's information for lawyers about the various jurisdictions in the United States. All right, let's move on to our final topic before our show closing materials. And that's going to be terms of service. We're going to talk some more, as we've been referencing throughout the show, about the state of contract formation. you told me when I was a law student taking contracts in my first year that when I was 51 years old, I'd be really, really interested in contract formation, I probably would have shot you. It's just not something that I could have ever conceived of. But again, when you throw technology into the mix, things get really, really interesting. And this is something that Venkat and Professor Goldman follow scrupulously on their technology and marketing law blog, namely the topic of how we form valid and enforceable contracts in a digital world. You wrote up a case recently that I think is great evidence of how this is all unfolding, Venkat. It's called Meyer versus Kalanick, if I'm pronouncing that right. And there, a judge declined to enforce Uber's terms of service in part because the terms of service, the contract was presented and accepted on a smartphone, and the court did not buy into the fact that the tiny, tiny print that appeared on the smartphone was something that could actually be valid notice of what was being agreed to. Can you tell us more about the case?
Yes, this was an antitrust case. It was actually brought against the founder or the CEO of Uber. And I don't remember if Uber was joined or was a party initially. But Uber, one of the defendants, moved to arbitrate the dispute on the basis that and it was brought by a driver, I believe, on the basis that the driver had agreed to an arbitration clause in Uber's terms of service that comes up when you first download Uber's app. And so the question was whether the person in registering the account initially had agreed to the terms of service and the arbitration clause in the terms of service. And for the most part, these agreements are in the analysis, as you alluded to initially, is fairly straightforward. Most 9 out of 10 times, a company that lets you create an account will display the terms of service to you, and then at the very end, sometimes make you scroll through the terms of service, and then at the very end, they'll just have a little box that says, "By checking on this box, I agree that I've read and agree to the agree to the terms of service." And 9 out of 10 times, that means that you have formed an enforceable contract, whether or not you actually do scroll through the terms of service and read them, and courts don't usually care about whether or not you read them, how long they are, et cetera. So one thing courts have not dealt with much is terms of service in apps and as agreed to on somebody's phone. And while that was not necessarily determinative here, that was something the court cited to in deciding to not enforce the terms of service and specifically the arbitration clause that was contained in the terms of service. And the thing the court pointed to, and I should point out this is a district court ruling by a judge that I think is kind of viewed as somebody who marches to the tune of his own drum, is that so it could very well be reversed on appeal, this ruling, and this is a district court ruling. The court looked to the fact that the arbitration clause was essentially buried and the terms of service themselves were just kind of in small print, and the process did not call out to the person registering the fact that they were signing up to waive their right to proceed in court with respect to a huge chunk of claims or a huge category of claims. So I think the big question this raises is what this means for other similarly deployed contracts, or whether this was just a one-off ruling by a judge who maybe wanted to make a point to Uber and say, you know, this doesn't feel right that Uber is trying to use its arbitration clause to quash an antitrust lawsuit that somebody's bringing. So pretty interesting ruling, and I don't know why. I really like these cases. I think they're fun, and then there's just a ton of different variations of whether terms of use in the online context are enforceable. So I enjoy following them.
I enjoy them too for the other reason, I think. I enjoy them, and it's a great way of sort of seeing the – legal hoops that you have to jump through in order to perpetuate this legal fiction that is that people are reading terms and conditions at all. You know, the idea that no matter how well buried an arbitration clause is, there could ever be a way for users to actually assent to these kind of contracts, I think is, you know, I hope something that eventually comes out, you know, is discussed in court. I think I know in your article, I think I would push back against the idea that we have that there are any real terms that use an expression of assent that is unequivocal. You know, whether you're talking a click wrap or any kind of click wrap agreement, you know, I mean, it's been South Parkified. We all know that no one is reading these and no one can read these, you know, if we took the time to actually read all of these agreements, I know that people have quantified out how long this would take and you'd be spending like years, literally nonstop years reading all of the agreements that we agree to. I think that what makes these kind of cases interesting is that it brings us closer and closer to recognizing that the reality today is that we are entering into far more contracts than we can possibly agree to, at least in the same sense of like what it meant to assent to a contract before. You know, especially as devices get smarter, you know, we're talking about services and technologies and devices that we're going to be entering into probably hundreds of contracts a day. I don't know the right way of handling this. I don't know the right way of presenting users with sufficient notice where they are actually given notice of what these contracts are saying. But yeah, it's an unsolved issue.
Yeah, I'm of two minds on the issue. And first, I have to thank Venkat for putting the Different Strokes theme now and for the rest of the day in my head with the judge who doesn't move to the beat of his own drum. But aside from that, I see both sides. I see that we have to have a means by which commerce moves forward. We have to have ways of forming valid and enforceable contracts. And yet no one reads these things, as you point out, Emery. I think maybe the saving grace here is there are a tiny minority of enthusiastic people who do read these things and publicize the outrageous clauses that they find. And I know that courts can't really rely on crowdsourced legal scrutiny and advice to give adequate notice to consumers accepting these contracts. But it does seem to me that there is some taking up of slack that happens in that way, where people, you know, learn when Niantic has an arbitration opt-out that, ooh, they better take advantage of that or they're going to find themselves in arbitration with the company. I think it's a fluid situation. On their blog, Venkat and Professor Goldman have a post entitled "Anarchy Has Ensued in Court's Handling of Online Contract Formation," and they round up everything pertinent on the topic to date. I think this was written before the Meyer case we just discussed, but it's a wonderful resource for people to look at and see and scratch their heads and go, yeah, courts haven't figured this out yet. And I'm wondering, Venkat, if you have seen any mention of what I'm alluding to here, that consumers, although they're not necessarily reading these contracts themselves, there's kind of a safety net in that the consumerist blog, for example, might catch something and make it more publicly known than it would otherwise be. Has any court latched onto that?
That's a really interesting point. And it has not been mentioned to my knowledge in the decisions that we've tracked. I think the one thing courts have alluded to is the studies and posts that people have done about how people do not read these contracts and maybe even the length of certain agreements, et cetera. But I think the crowdsourced aspect of it is really interesting, but it's not something to date, to my knowledge, that courts have picked up on or pointed to as a safety net.
No.
To other safety nets you're talking about, Denise, I am encouraged by projects like the Hello Vote and Do Not Pay. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that this is the kind of area where some kind of artificial intelligent assistant could, you know, help users comb through privacy policies and understand, you know, the essential terms. I've seen some people, some projects are definitely working on that already. To the earlier FCC talk that we had, you know, as part of the proposal for bias providers that Tom Wheeler is proposing, I just dropped the sentence in the middle of the sentence, but the proposal included
opt-in notice. That's
the proposal included a multi-stakeholder rulemaking procedure where they are urging companies to, again, come to the drawing table and try to make a form of a universal notice or privacy notice, some kind of standardized privacy notice that, you know, might be have some kind of API or that can be easily interpreted through machine reading or that, you know, in any case is more standardized so that users at least know where to look every time, you know. And those, again, whether that – I am far less optimistic that that actually bears fruit. That's a project that has been proposed multiple times before and has been attempted multiple times before. It has just never really succeeded because there hasn't really been any actual law behind requiring businesses to do that. But at the same time, yeah, you know, maybe somewhere down the line, we finally get to a point where privacy policies and terms and conditions need to be standardized. I think that is a common sense regulation that, you know, would not hurt businesses in the least, because, you know, basically all of these are boilerplate for the vast majority of these licenses. So
right. And I really like the concept that Creative Commons uses too, where there's a plain English version of all the licenses that, you know, doesn't go into all their detail, but gives you the salient points. And maybe that's a direction that parties with terms of service should be urged to go, where it's not 48
not
pages long
easy,
and
though.
there's no splainer.
You know,
Virgil suggested a title for the show, which is Lucy Splains Contracts. And I guess what I'm looking for is some splaining.
Yeah. I mean, that's one of the problems with plain English translation, you know, translations of EULAs and privacy policies, is that it's not always easy to give a plain English description of everything that's in these policies, because everything is in there for a reason and the wording is usually very particular. It's just, you know, the problem with legalese in general. Can it be made better? Absolutely. Could it be made better through standardization? I certainly think so. But is that going to solve the problem? I don't think it's necessarily going to mean that people are reading their policies. Or necessarily gets to the heart of the issue of whether or not users are assenting to contracts, which is really what this is asking.
Yeah. Mike, any thoughts before we wrap up the show?
Boy, nothing further here. I think you guys covered just about everything.
Once again, first year contract me is just laughing and shaking her head. I'm so fascinated in this issue now. All right.
Professor Kim at California Western School of Law offers an excellent class on this exact subject.
Who does? Professor?
Professor Kim.
Professor Kim. So it's not just contract law. It's specifically online contract formation.
Yeah. Yeah. Her wheelhouse is absolutely on how online contract formation. It's a scholarly writing class. I highly encourage everyone check it out if you're in California Western School of Law in Southern San Diego. So it's kind of particular, but at the same time relevant.
Okay, so the professor's going to come looking to you when the class all of a sudden is being shadowed by countless interested internet.
She has a book called, well, let me look it up. I think it's called Boilerplate. But anyways, I'll chime in later with that book.
Cool. All right. I think we're ready to move to our animal selfie of the week. All right, Victor, show us an ant. we're going with this as a selfie, along with the footnote in the New Hampshire ballot selfie decision, which would be any picture taken with, well, we don't know if this was taken with a smartphone, but I'm fairly certain that it was posted online because Mike found it. There we go. A nice head of some kind of ant that I'm not sure what it's called. But if you are interested in ants at all, I'm going to give one more plug to Ants Canada and their YouTube channel, which has more information about ants in the wild and ants in your home as welcome guests in your home than you would ever have thought existed. And it's actually entertaining. The guy there, Mikey Bustoff is his name, and he's a wonderful online personality, I gotta say. We have one more animal selfie of the week before the ant, and this is a pit bull, and it actually, this serves as not just an animal selfie of the week, but a tip of the week, because here is a gentleman. Oh, I'm blanking on his name now here. I'm gonna pull up the article so I can tell you who he is. But he lives in— it's Dan Tillery, yes, thank you. He lives in Waterford Township, Michigan. He adopted a pit— controversial whether the dog he adopted is a pit bull, but a pit bull-esque dog from a local shelter. His community, like many out there, has an anti-pit bull ownership ordinance. Those are highly controversial, and I think on the decline as more and more people realize that these animals are filling shelters and, if raised properly, make really delightful pets. And here's Dan showing off how that is the case. However, he sort of got— the tip involved here is after he posted the picture, and I believe the shelter posted rescue operation posted the picture too. It was very well received online. In fact, I think the rescue place said, "We're going to break the internet with this photo," because they realized quite how cute it was. And indeed, it spread far and wide, and it spread to his local legal enforcement agency, who went, you have a pit bull that certainly appears to be a pit bull, and they're not allowed here. So they actually took the doggy away for a little while, and then controversy ensued. Veterinarians signed opinions were solicited as to the breed of the dog, there was some confirmation that this doggy is not, in fact, a pit bull. It looks very pit bull like to me, and it reminds me of the time when we almost adopted a pit bull puppy, realizing only that it was extraordinarily cute, and being told by the rescue operation that it was an American Staffordshire Terrier, which is, I guess, technically not a pit bull, and maybe evades anti-pit bull ordinances, but sure looks a heck of a lot like a pit bull. Anyway, so our animal selfie slash tip is, yes, please do adopt your local rescue animals, but be a little cautious in posting their adorable selfies if you live in an un-pit bull friendly zone. Let's see, we have one other tip of the week for you, and in summing up what the tip is, I just put in the rundown, "Oh snap," because what the more precise tip should be is, better check the license when you're tweeting bulls of Skittles. This Donald J. Trump Jr. A few weeks ago famously posted his bull of Skittles in relation to the Syrian refugee problem. In fact, I misspoke when I said it was his bowl of Skittles. It was not. It was a photo that was originally posted to Flickr by someone who turns out to have been a refugee in his own right, a UK-based photographer, David Kittos, a former refugee. He posted it to Twitter with no license whatsoever, and that didn't prevent it from becoming the subject of Donald J. Trump Jr.'s post, controversial post. And when you go and pull up that post now, guess what? The image has been removed because the photographer sent a DMCA takedown notice to Twitter. So no more will you see the bowl of Skittles in that tweet because Twitter complied with the takedown notice. And I assume that will be that on this. This points us further to one of our resources of the week, which, if you're interested in seeing the photographer's DMCA takedown notices, you can view it at lumendatabase.org, which is a great resource maintained by the Berkman Center at Harvard with a number of partners, including EFF, that attempts to aggregate DMCA notices from various places who make them publicly available and make them searchable. So this Lumen database is very valuable if you're interested to see if something has been subject to a DMCA takedown notice or if someone has filed one. File that away in your list of resources. And then our final resource for you is a map courtesy of NBC News that helpfully tells you in which state you may take a photo, in which states you may take a photo of your ballot, and in which ones you may not, and in which ones it's an open question. Nice little infographic there for you. If you're dying to just photograph and post your ballot, you can only do so in a handful of states definitively, which include Oregon, Utah, Arizona, Wyoming, North Dakota, Indiana, Delaware, New Hampshire, and Maine. So if you're not in that those states, you should think twice on the whole ballot selfie thing, or at least research further. This has been a really, really exceptionally fun show. I'm so glad that you guys have been able to join me today. Venkat, tell me what's going on in your practice or going on with the blog that you do with Professor Goldman or anything else you want to tell us before we wrap up the show.
I was going to say fall is here and it feels like a very classically gloomy Seattle day. So I am getting ready to get a cup of coffee and enjoy that after this. So,
so Seattle.
The very most Seattle. It was great to be on the show. I really enjoyed it, and I would love to come back again in the near future.
We'd love to have you. Thank you so much for returning with us, and have a great fall. Enjoy. Oh God, do they even have pumpkin spice in Seattle, or is it banned there? Because it's just not cool enough.
I think it's everywhere.
All right. Well, that's sad to hear. Mike, are you off to get your latte as well?
I've already had a couple today, so I better cool it. That's going to be it for me. I did want to mention one thing. We are hosting on October 17th a great INTA roundtable at Dorsey in Seattle. Venkat, hopefully you and your colleagues will be able to join us. It's called Emerging Issues in the Digital Marketplace, and we're going to talk about all sorts of interesting trademark-related issues when it comes to online e-commerce issues. So it's from 12 to 2 on October 17th. So come and, awesome. And enjoy lunch, and we'll talk about some really interesting issues.
Awesome.
Will that be streamed by any chance?
It won't be, unfortunately.
Well, we'll have to get the cliff notes from you then.
Yeah.
Sure.
Absolutely. Fill us in after the fact. We'll make sure and circle back with you on that. Emery, anything going on with you that you want to let us know about before we wrap up today?
No, nothing really. Continuing through the last year of law school. I've got some exciting opportunities presenting themselves, panel presentations later this month. If you're going to be in San Diego, Cyberfest is coming again October 27th. It's an annual cybersecurity conference. I'm going to be on a panel talking about something that we still have to work out. But yeah, just happy to be here. Excited about next week. It's going to be Twill's 10th anniversary.
Hey.
You know, can't tell everyone how excited and proud and lucky I feel to be part of this project. And I'm looking forward to having Evan Brown back on the show next week. So keep it tuned here.
Yeah. I'm really looking forward to having Evan back too. I'm looking forward to celebrating being here and been there, still here, I guess is the phrase, and really happy to have had the opportunity to do that. So happy that folks like Venkat consent to be in our company each week and that Emery and Mike are on board with me each and every week. It's just such a treat to do the show. It really, really is a delight. And we hope that you will help us do the show by getting in touch with us between the shows. You can get us on Twitter. That's a great way to get in touch. As we know, you could even potentially serve us with process there. I don't know. But if you're not planning to file any lawsuits, just, you know, send us a tweet. We'd love to hear who you think we should invite on the show, what you think we should talk about, further thoughts you have about the things we've discussed and brought up. Great way to get in touch with us is there. We maintain a couple of lists of our discussion points for the show if you want to delve deeper into the things that we've looked at to be inspired for our discussions here. We keep a Flipboard list at flipboard.com. At D Howell is where all my magazines are there. And then tagpacker.com/user/thisweekinlaw is where we break down all the links for each particular show. You should email us between the shows. I'm Denise at twit.tv. Mike is Mike at twit.tv. Emery is Emery at twit.tv. Please do use those to tell us anything more lengthy or confidential than something you want to put on social media. If you'd rather find us on Facebook and Google+, we are in those places too. And we do record this show every Friday at 11 o'clock Pacific time in the AM, 1800 UTC. And go for about 2 hours. So block out some time if you're going to join us for the show. Or if you'd like to break it up more, listen to it more on your own time and your own schedule, please just head over to our show page at twit.tv/twill. Our whole archive is there for you. You can go back and be delighted at Klingon briefs and many other things that we've discussed throughout the years. All residing there for you, as well as various ways you can enjoy the show, whether it's on your phone or your computer or your TV, via iTunes, whatever floats your boat. Roku is a great way to go to. However and whenever you join us, we're just thrilled that you do, and we will be back with you next week on This Week in Law. Take care.